Welcome back to Current State. You're listening to 90.5 WKAR, and I'm Mark Bayshore. Last night was the first of three Lansing Board of Water and Light public forums for more input regarding the utility's response to the recent ice storm. Current State's Joe Lindstroth was there last night. He reports that about 20 or so speakers vented frustration and shared suggestions. State Rep Sam Singh among them, suggesting that it's worth looking at best practices at other municipally owned utilities. General Manager Peter Lark and other administrators were in attendance. They shared a prepared statement, apologized profusely, and then mostly just listened after that. But a reminder that similar gatherings are tonight and tomorrow night. Tonight at the Delta Township Administration Building on West Saginaw, Room A, 7 p.m., and tomorrow night at the Rio Town Depot, also at 7 p.m. BWL customers in particular are invited. I'll be attending tomorrow night's meeting. And have we entered an era in which we can no longer rely on antibiotics as much as we have in the past? An uncomfortable notion, really, we'll explore with Dr. Chris Waters of the MSU Microbiology and Molecular Genetics Department in just a few minutes. At the top today, for 2 years, Flint native Michael Brown served as the City of Flint's emergency manager. He has recently returned to Prima Civitas in East Lansing as its president. And Michael Brown joins Current State to talk about his efforts in Flint and what lay ahead for Prima Civitas. Welcome back to Current State, Mike.
Pleasure to be here,
Happy,
Mark.
Happy New Year.
Thank you.
Your history in Flint is extensive. I think a lot of people know that. You grew up there. You owned a business there. Spent 4 years in Genesee County government, even serving as acting mayor of Flint back in 2009, and then emergency manager. Tell us about what you found in Flint when you arrived as EM 2 years ago.
Well, what we found was a financial emergency. We had about a budget deficit that was projected at $20 million. The inability to provide adequate police and fire services. We had, of course, aging infrastructure, and we had a water system where we had a surplus back in 07 of $60 million, and it was at a $23 million deficit when I walked in the door. We had what's called OPEB liability, post-employment benefits, lot around health care. That was right on the border of $1 billion underfunded. So we had major kinds of financial issues and public safety issues and infrastructure issues to face.
And looking back from today's perspective, how much were you able to change? How is the landscape different today?
Well, what I think we did, what we achieved, was to put Flint on a path to solvency. We're on a different trajectory than Detroit, for instance. I think with the debt that they had in Detroit, bankruptcy was practically the only option. Flint didn't have that kind of debt. So if we could, learn to live within our means, I had to lay off 25% of the workforce, for instance, in that first year. We were able to reduce that OPEB liability from close to $1 billion down to about $366 million. Mm. It's still a lot of money, but with changes that we made in healthcare and how it is delivered to our active workers and retirees, we were able to reduce that. The pension had a $400 million unfunded liability. We were able to transfer the Flint retirement system to the Michigan Employment Retirement System. So FERS to MERS, it's called, which really will provide better service at lower fees for our workers and our retirees. So one critical piece was that our cash flow was so low that we were worried that whether we could make payroll. Okay,
right.
It was like the previous administration had borrowed $8 million from the state. So pooled cash was at about $10 million. When I left, it was at $49 million. So, you know, we made some significant progress, and like I say, I think it's on a path to solvency. It's not out of the woods. There's still very tough decisions to make. You know, just the stabilizing the public safety. It's still a major problem, and if there's one thing that I feel like we could have done a better job was to make Flint safer. So that there's still a lot of work to do around that.
Was the progress you made possible largely as a result of the special powers that you enjoyed, special authority that you enjoyed as an emergency manager?
Well, we couldn't have moved that swiftly. Okay, we needed to move swiftly, and the legislation allowed us to do that. But if you take, I mentioned this to you before the show, but like Darnell Early up in Saginaw faced a lot of the same problems. He was a city manager. He did a great job of keeping them out of receivership.
Without an emergency manager.
Without an emergency manager, yeah. So I think he was a great choice by the governor to come into Flint, and he had some history in Flint. So I think, again, it's on the right path, but still a lot of work to do.
Given your tenure as emergency manager, I have to ask you what your thoughts are regarding the city of Detroit and the upheaval that it has gone through just in the past 6 months or so.
Sure. Well, again, from my perspective, it's positive. I think that, you know, the bottom really fell out of the economy in Detroit with General Motors bankruptcy and then all the impact of that on other manufacturing, on other service industry. And so the tax base that, you know, supported 1.5 to 2 million people at one time just was not there anymore. So now you at least have somebody who is addressing the issues. And there's no easy decisions there. I mean, you know, bankruptcy is a tough way to go, but again, their debt was so much. I mean, they had borrowed, I think it was $300 million just to make payroll.
Mm-hmm.
Okay. I mean, Flint didn't have that kind of debt.
And what was its OPEB?
It was in the billions.
The moon and the stars.
In the billions.
Yeah.
Yes.
Yeah. What are you going to continue to advise Darnell Early in any way? I'm curious. I'm under the impression that your new role or your returning to Prima Civitas, how will you continue to be involved?
Well, I certainly told Mr. Early that if there's anything that he needs, you know, I'm a phone call away. But what I'll tell you is we put a team in place. I mean, one of the other things that we focused on was what was the culture in Flint of the workforce. And we brought some new young people in. You know, if you think about Michigan and the brain drain that we've had, a lot of good young talent leaving. We made an effort like around finance, human resources, to identify real quality young people who live in Flint, have a stake in Flint, and now they're helping run those operations. So that was part of the future as far as I'm concerned.
Did other emergency managers do that you're aware of? I mean,
you know, I didn't really have a lot of interaction with other emergency managers,
okay.
So I don't know
it
that.
It seems like a great move. It seems like a innovative idea.
We felt it was logical, you know, because you got to think about what happens when you leave. And so to kind of put a team in place, and really Mr. Early has really left that team in place that we put together.
Do you think he'll be able to do that? Or do you think he and the other people at the top, Dane Walling and the city council and others,
sure.
Are you generally confident about the future of the city? Do you think they can continue to make progress?
I am. I'm very positive. You know, I'll give you an example. Even within this receivership time, there's been $500 million of new investment in downtown Flint. And, you know, we're now looking at other projects in downtown Flint, talking to Michigan State University about the College of Human Medicine and expanding their presence. They've been in Flint for 30 years. But
is that institutional investment or private or both? Or, I mean, what's the big part of the meal there in terms of that investment?
It was private investment.
Okay.
Private investment. And that's significant that people who see what's happening in Flint are still willing to make that kind of investment.
It's the Dan Gilbert dynamic only taking place in Flint.
Absolutely.
Okay. Did you feel that you were able to truly connect with the city's residents during your tenure as EM?
Well, you know, because I was born and raised in Flint, I mean, I knew a lot of people, and I wasn't, I mean, I lived in many neighborhoods in Flint, so I was comfortable wherever I went. And even if there was animosity, I mean, I made an effort to go to every ward in Flint and give a presentation the first 2 months I was there. And, you know, I got a lot of negative feedback, okay? But, you know, half the people that came to the microphone I knew. And so I think part of that is just I have a great respect for the people in Flint, and not that they were going to agree with me on every decision, but I was able to say, look, we're going to have to do some things that are going to be very uncomfortable, but in order to get us on the right path, we have to do this kind of thing. And, you know, it was...
Did it get better over the 2 years, or did it get worse?
I wouldn't say that it got better, and I think part of that is not the financial stuff so much. It was more the infrastructure and the public safety things. You know, the kinds of things that citizens deal with every day that they didn't see getting better. Mm-hmm. I mean, you're just not going to be able to have that kind of an impact, I don't think, in a quick way. On the finances, we were able to do some things because of the law, and we did them.
We're talking with Mike Brown, former emergency manager for the city of Flint and a Lansing resident, a Flint native, but a Lansing resident. I think about you. I envision you getting up every morning at your home in Lansing, driving to Flint, where you had all this authority and responsibility, and then driving back to Lansing every night. You were a man of two cities for a couple of years there. What was that like?
Well, really, it was good to be able to just step away for, you know, even if it was 8 to 12 hours, just to come back, kind of rethink it. And, you know, I'm driving in every day and you're thinking about the day ahead. So it actually was good for me. You know, and there, I think there is a case to be made that people who administrate a city should live in a city. But, you know, I had paid my dues in Flint. I lived there all my life. I raised all my kids, five kids that went to the Flint schools, got a great education in the Flint schools. The Flint community schools were, you know, we had people from all over the world who would come and go through there because they were open from 7 a.m. to 10 at night, 5 days a week. I mean, that's a history of Flint that's mm-hmm. very positive that people just don't realize is there. So, you know, Flint was good to me. It was good to my family. And so for me to go back and serve as I've done, it was not tough work, you know.
What advice, what's the best advice that you have offered Darnell Early, Dane Walling, the city council, in terms of what's on your short list as to suggestions for how they should move ahead?
Well, certainly perseverance. I mean, you know, this to keep this on the right course, there are still a lot of tough decisions to make. I think secondly, and I'll give the mayor credit for this, you know, he put together a grant to the federal government to have a new master plan for the city. And they've been implementing that master plan now for the last couple of years. First, they put it together, and now they're in the implementation phase. And this is a huge thing. Flint hadn't had a master plan for 50 years, okay? Not since the 60s. So I think to stay the course on that, to follow that plan, to have citizen engagement. I mean, I was at one meeting that the mayor put together last year, and 500 people showed up on a Saturday morning to look at the city of Flint and how do we go forward. Mm. That's encouraging. And so I just say stay the course on those kinds of things, but persevere. Don't back off at all.
I want to ask you about the perception and the importance of perception here. How sensitive to that were you during your tenure? How sensitive to that are you now? And is the perception of the city arguably worse than its reality?
Absolutely. Absolutely. You know, Flint has a very negative reputation and perception. And like I say, just the opposite is true from my experience. Okay, I grew up there. I grew up at a time when schools were open to the entire family. I mean, men, women could go there for training. You know, after school closed, they were open. The Charles Stewart Mott Foundation was just a tremendous benefactor for Flint, is still there and is still doing a tremendous job for Flint. So, and then, you know, we had the highest per capita income in the country at one time. Mm-hmm. So we had workers who could send their children to college and who would never have to walk into a plant and work again because they could pay for their education, that kind of thing. So we have a cultural center for a blue-collar town that's second to none, a planetarium, Institute of Arts, Institute of Music, Whiting Auditorium. I mean, we have kids who come from 50 miles away to go to the Institute of Music, okay? Those are assets that any community can build around. We've got 34...
And are overlooked, arguably overlooked, and, yeah, that is not the story that gets out about the city of Flint.
34,000 college students, you know, Kettering University, one of the top engineering universities in the country. University of Michigan is in Flint, just like they're in Dearborn. Mott Community College was just ranked one of the top 10 community colleges in the country in the last 2 years. Baker College, one of the fastest growing private colleges in the Midwest. So tremendous assets to build around.
I know the public-private partnership with Kettering University has been quite a spark for the city as well. Talk to us about that.
Oh, absolutely. Well, just, you know, while I was there, you know, we had a stadium that's right stone's throw from Kettering, and it's been, you know, deteriorating for two decades because the city, nobody had the money to put in to refurbish it. So Kettering stepped up in the last year and said, you know, we'll take it over. You give it to us and we'll make sure the schools can use it for ball games, but this is part of our neighborhood. We want to see it refurbished and mm-hmm. be an asset for the whole neighborhood. So, and of course, the kinds of training of engineers that takes place there, connection to industry, particularly manufacturing industry, that we still need, you know, in this country. So Kettering is a tremendous asset for the city of Flint.
How are the roles of Mayor Dane Walling and the city council playing out here as we head into 2014?
Well, that's a great question, and it is a significant role because what I think Mr. Early has to do is, and he's already done it, start thinking about the transition back to mayor and council.
Okay.
How does that take place? So he has formed a 21-member committee to look at, you know, what does a transition look like? What's the role of the mayor and city council? What charter changes might we need to institute as it is handed back? So that's going to be a great discussion.
Happen, by the
that's
way.
Happening, right? He appointed the committee. So my understanding is that there'll be a facilitator for that process. The mayor and the council will be involved in that process. I'd say great vision on his part, on Darnell Early's part.
But when will the city no longer have an emergency manager?
Well, I can't predict that. Like I say, there are still real tough decisions to make. You know, we were able to reduce the deficit from that $20 million down to $13 million just in 1 year, but that you still got a $13 million deficit. So can they erase that in the next year? Maybe. I mean, like I say, I think it's in capable hands with Darnell Early, and I think they're moving in the right direction. But it's hard to predict. If you look at the average stay of an emergency manager, it's about 3 years. So if you looked at next December, for instance,
that'll be 3 years.
That'd be 3 years. So, again, they're on a good path, and I think that is continuing under Mr. Early's leadership, and I believe they're going to.
How did the community respond to a change in emergency managers? How do they feel about Mike Brown out, Darnell Early in? What did that play out in any curious kind of way?
Not really, and I'll tell you, we actually went through three because, you know, the law changed while I was there.
That's
too.
That's right.
And yeah. I had to leave for a while. Ed Kurtz came in. I think here's an amazing thing, is that the team that we put together originally stayed in place. So the people who were really doing the work, you know, in finance, in infrastructure, in public safety, whether it was police and fire, they have been in place. And I think that the work has continued no matter who the manager was. I think that's significant, and that speaks well for Flint and the cooperation. I think, you know, the mayor was worked very well with me, very well with Ed Kurtz, very well with Darnell Early now. So I think there's responsible people there that want to do the right thing, and they want Flint to thrive again.
Is Flint becoming safer? Is that still a particular challenge?
Yes, I believe that's a particular challenge. Okay. You know, with gangs and guns and kids and drugs, you got issues there that have impacted the public safety, the entire community, and that's going to take a while to clean up.
What's it like to be back in the saddle, really, at Prima Civitas? Or do you not regard it as that big of a transition?
Oh, no.
You were there before. So.
Right. I think it's fantastic. You know, Prima Civitas was started with a vision by President Luana Simon from Michigan State University. Dave Hollister came in, did a great job, and now Steve Webster has really taken it in some new directions, particularly the international direction. And I think that the work that it's still doing regionally with communities along the I-69 corridor that are trying to, you know, take brownfields and redevelop them and get new investment, those are the kinds of things Prima Civitas is working on. And I'm excited about being able to come back and make a contribution now.
Michael Brown is a Flint native, Lansing resident, and was the emergency manager for the city of Flint for a couple of years. He is now back at work as president at Prima Civitas of East Lansing. Great to see you, Mike. Good luck, and we'll talk again.
Thanks, Mark. Good to be here.
It's Current State on 90.5 WKAR. Thanks for joining us. The U.S. Centers for Disease Control has published an assessment of the threat Americans face from antibiotic-resistant germs, and it's a bit sobering. The report is the first time hard numbers have been reported for deaths and costs related to fighting diseases that no longer respond to antibiotics. A few numbers: 23,000 deaths, and an additional $20 billion a year in health care spending. Joining us to talk about the CDC report is Dr. Christopher Waters of MSU's Microbiology and Molecular Genetics Department. Welcome to Current State.
Hi, Mark. Thanks for having me. I really appreciate you taking on this topic. This is
sure.
a really important concern.
Well, first of all, give us the layman's version of what you study here at MSU.
So my lab studies actually a process called bacterial biofilm formation. And so this is a process where bacteria attach to surfaces and they can secrete extracellular matrix material. And this actually helps protect them from antibiotics. So it's part of this resistance problem.
Okay.
So if you get these kinds of infections on artificial surfaces like a hip implant or a catheter or a pacemaker, and these infections can't be cleared by antibiotics. So we're trying to find new ways to target these infections, and we're also developing new small molecules that target biofilms.
We wanted to have someone on the show to follow up on this CDC assessment involving antibiotic-resistant organisms. It's a pretty scary thought. I mean, they're essentially saying many antibiotics will increasingly not work on a number of illnesses anymore. Kind of like saying you can't use water to put out fires anymore. Explain what happens to bacteria and other organisms that make them that enable them to resist antibiotics?
Sure. Well, it's really basic evolution. So if you think about what is an antibiotic is a small molecule whose purpose is to kill bacteria. And these can be produced from natural sources. They can also be synthetically made by people. And so what these small molecules do is target processes in bacteria that are essential for growth. So bacteria are quite small, and they can exist in large population sizes of millions or billions or trillions of cells. And due to natural genetic variation, so natural mutation, there's always a few bacteria in the population that have resistance to these antibiotics. So you can imagine these are mutations that disrupt the target of the antibiotic. So the antibiotic can't bind to the target. So when you treat these populations with antibiotics, what happens is 99.999% of all the population is killed, but those few cells that are resistant remain. And so now they repopulate this space, and you've gone from a population of susceptible bacteria to one that's resistant. And this happens over and over and over in the environment and during infections, and that's how resistance emerges.
Was this inevitable?
It is inevitable. So for every antibiotic that's been introduced, the first antibiotic that was widely used was penicillin back in the 1940s. And it's really interesting. You can look and see when resistance developed, and it's usually within a few years. And it's really just evolution in action. Resistance is going to develop. Now, that doesn't mean that we can't try to limit it or manage it as much as possible, but resistance will develop.
Many of the illnesses mentioned in the CDC report have been considered treatable for a long time. Salmonella, gonorrhea. As a scientist, does it feel strange to you to see things that once were curable move toward being more difficult to cure?
Well, I mean, as a microbiologist and someone who also studies evolution, I've been aware of this problem for a long time. So it actually makes quite a bit of sense to me that bacteria will evolve resistance. So this is something that has been on the radar screen for a long time, and I'm really glad the CDC came out with this report and we're talking about this issue, because this is really something that, as you mentioned, is kind of a grim prospect, you know, if we can't
Indeed.
Treat these infections. And so it's something that we need to start really dealing with, because it's going to take a few years to start to come up with new antibiotics.
Do things like antibacterial soap help, or do they make things worse?
There's a lot of debate on that issue. I think the literature says that you don't really need antibacterial soap, that you can get resistance to those as well, that just washing your hands using standard soap is perfectly acceptable.
And part is this challenge accentuated by the fact that we use stronger antibiotics than are necessary, then? Isn't that what underlay a part of this?
I think it more has to do with we use antibiotics when we shouldn't. So part of the CDC report...
It's not so much the strength, it's the frequency.
Right. Okay. So the CDC estimated that 50% of all medical use of antibiotics was unnecessary. So these are things like, you know, viral colds or viral flus. People go in and, you know, I have three kids, so I get this. Your kid's sick, you go to the doctor, you want to have a pill that makes them feel better. But if you're using antibiotics for things that aren't bacterial infections, then this is leading to more resistance.
Is this an issue you feel the public is adequately aware of?
No, not at all. Absolutely not. So I think people still have the impression that, you know, they'll always be able to go in the doctor, get an antibiotic, and take care of this infection. And you, as you mentioned, that the resistance is just growing and growing and growing. So we could reach a point where if we don't develop new antibiotics, where that's not the case, where we go to the pre-antibiotic era, where we just don't have these things. And when I think about the pre-antibiotic era, you know, you think about these Civil War battles where soldiers got infections, and the only way they could really treat these infections
Amputation,
was to get out the saw. And really, that's not that far off if we lose the ability to use these antibiotics. And the other thing I would mention, too, is it's not just infections that's the problem. It's all of these other medical treatments that we do. So if you think about cancer chemotherapy, right, or complex surgery that has the ability to introduce bacteria deep within tissue, or organ transplant where you suppress the immune system. All of these things rely on having antibiotics to limit secondary infections. So if we lose the ability to use antibiotics, then not only do we have this problem with infections, all these other medical treatments become much more dangerous. So it's really a scary thought.
We're talking with Dr. Chris Waters of MSU's Microbiology and Molecular Genetics Department about antibiotic-resistant germs and what lay ahead. Should a patient who's aware of this situation, should a patient whose doctor recommends an antibiotic maybe resist that prescription or question that prescription in an effort to try to make the situation better?
Well, I think patients should be aware that antibiotics aren't a cure-all for all infections. So I think there needs to be conversations with doctors about, is this a bacterial infection? Is this a viral infection? I mean, if it's not confirmed that it's bacterial, maybe you want to hold out, wait for the tests to actually determine what kind of infection it is.
So there must be some number of physicians who overprescribe antibiotics, too. I mean, we're talking millions, a population of millions. Are there physicians who overprescribe antibiotics?
Sure, there is antibiotics. I mean, 50%, right, of antibiotics were used when they shouldn't have been. So I think physicians are becoming more aware of the problem, and I think the CDC report will help, but there's certainly room for improvement. So there's another issue, too. Antibiotics, actually 80% of all antibiotics in the country are used in agricultural settings, believe it or not. So these are...
What does that mean?
Well, these are farms, food farms, so animal farms. Antibiotics are just given in food to try and help health and increase the growth of farm animals. And in many cases, these are not needed. So these tons of antibiotics are being pumped into the environment, and bacteria in these animals are being exposed to antibiotics, and resistance is developing.
Very good. Quickly, can you tell me what encourages you? What single thing encourages you?
Yeah, well, I think we've got a lot of academic institutions that are developing new antibiotics, and if we can keep up the federal research for funding, we can start to keep developing these and put them in the pipeline.
We're talking antibiotic-resistant germs. We want to thank our guest, Dr. Chris Waters of MSU's Microbiology and Molecular Genetics Department. Thank you, Christopher. Good luck.
All right. Thank you very much.
Current state on WKAR, microbreweries have been popping up all over the state, the Lansing area included. But what about micro roasters? Current state's Emmanuel Berry recently took a visit to the founders of Craft and Mason Coffee, a new micro roaster in the Lansing area. Emmanuel joins us here. Tell us about Craft and Mason.
Well, Craft and Mason is a brainchild of two friends, Eric Craft and Jeremy Mason. And first of all, aren't their names perfect for creating a coffee brand?
It is.
Yeah. Anyway, but the pair recently developed, they really have developed a passion for coffee. So they decided to take their love to the next level and start roasting and selling their own beans. And I went to check out their setup. And what I've learned more than anything is that I don't know a lot about coffee. but I also learned that there's kind of a sense of artistry to the entire roasting process. One of the founders, Jeremy Mason, said he knew about as much as I did a while back about coffee, and he first discovered his love at a beer festival.
And after half a day of, you know, hanging out with people and trying different beers, there was a little coffee stand set up. And for whatever reason, I'd never been much of a coffee drinker really my entire life, but I decided to go order a cappuccino. And that cappuccino tasted like nothing I'd ever had before. And so I'm the type of person that sort of dives in when I find something interesting. Mm-hmm. So from there, you know, once I found a coffee that I really enjoyed, I started, you know, trying to visit more cafes. There's some really good ones in Michigan, out in California, and just wherever I went out, I would look up different coffee shops and coffee roasters. And eventually I found out you could roast your own beans. And I saw green beans, and that was just fascinating to me. So I started, you know, I bought a little popcorn roaster at Salvation
roaster.
Army. Yeah. Believe it or not, you can get like a, you know, at Salvation Army, an old school popcorn roaster, a specific kind, and that will roast coffee for you. And there's a really cool site called Sweet Maria's. And he actually visits farms all over the world and works out contracts with farmers directly, and then he'll sell the beans to home roasters. And that was my introduction. But I loved it. I mean, roasting coffee to me has never gotten old. You transform a green bean into this, you know, amazing roasted product. It's fresh. You can grind it fresh in the morning. It smells so good. And that was what really got me interested.
Eric, how did Jeremy drag you into this?
It's funny you say that, because that's kind of, I mean, it's a lot of what he just said. But it was, I don't know, we were going to some party function or something where people were bringing, I think it was like a breakfast actually prior to going to a winter beer fest. And we like to eat a lot of breakfast and drink coffee before we go. And Jeremy decided to bring some of these roasted beans. He walked to the door and had these, and everyone was like, yeah, Jeremy brought his own, you know, roasted beans. And I was like, roasted beans? What are you talking about? And so it really was through him, honestly. We both have a passion for brewing, and it just, I immediately got excited about coffee as well.
So you guys decided to take this hobby or passion and turn it into a business. Jeremy, tell me a little bit about the philosophy behind Craft & Mason Coffee.
Well, when we started the business, we wanted to do a couple of things. The first thing is just, we believe that fresh coffee tastes the best. And there was no one that we knew of locally, you know, that kind of really focused on that. So that was part of it. It's, you know, we sell online and we ship the next day. And so it's really easy for people to order and then get it within a couple of days. Secondly, if you look at kind of the whole coffee chain and the way it works globally, it's a commodity market. Coffee is priced, it has more of a global price, and it doesn't really matter where it's from. If you step outside that market, it's called a specialty coffee. And specialty coffee is more traced on quality, and it's you pay more for a quality product. In that instance, what we do is we actually try and trace it back to the farmer. And when you do that, you are bringing the farmer into the value chain. So we want to know, you know, first of all, we want to find a coffee that we love. And second of all, we want to ask the question, why do we love this coffee? Mm-hmm. And so we want to know where it's from, you know, how high it was grown, what did the farmer do, how did they process his coffee? Mm-hmm. Interesting, if you look at what it takes to actually get a pound of coffee, someone is hand-picking 2,000 coffee cherries.
Wow.
And so, you know, when you start to learn these details and you know that there's a person behind the coffee, there's a farmer and a family who actually is passionate and incredibly hardworking at producing a product that's superior and excellent, you sip your coffee differently in the morning. You appreciate what your coffee tastes like because you know there's an actual person behind this cup. And it's not, you know, I don't want it to sound philanthropic. It's really because they've created an excellent product. And so we're willing to pay for that, and we want to celebrate the work that the farmer has done.
Eric, tell me a little bit about how you guys educated yourself about coffee. I mean, we've got a roaster going in the background here. How did you get to the point where you knew what to do with that?
Well, we had done quite a bit of research prior to with just lots of online research, really starting with, to be honest, Sweet Maria's, which a lot of home roasters use. That guy is crazy knowledgeable, and he's got tons of references and information. And so we just, aside from him, I mean, we just, all the information that we could possibly get, we looked into, you know, articles. Roast Magazine, Willem Boot is another guy who's just filled full of information, and he's a guy that started quite a while back. I don't know a lot of the history about him, but he's really well respected and is responsible for a magazine called Roast Magazine. We've done a lot of research and also just trial and error. I mean, we spent a lot of time with the other machines prior to this machine, as far as just roasting small batch samples and just tasting through them and cupping, lots of cupping the coffees. So, yeah.
So let's go see how you make a cup of coffee.
We walk back into a small room where the roaster, the size of a coffee table, is sitting. It looks confusing, but Eric says it's not.
Well, it's really actually quite simple, honestly. I mean, you have a heat source, and this one is run by gas, by natural gas. And it, there's just a drum housed inside of this casing that you see here that's all shiny. And we're going to introduce heat to the beans at specific temperatures. So we're going to get to a certain temperature where we'll drop the beans at that temperature, depending on what coffee we're roasting. And then from that, whoa, that's obnoxious, sorry. And then from there, we're basically going to track it with roast log. This is a way for us to track all the information and data in on a graph, and then save that information and data, and you know, look back at it and see what exactly we've done to the bean that's, you know, given us those flavors.
Beyond tracking the temperature on a graph, the software also helps them determine when the beans reach first and second crack. Jeremy explains.
There's different reactions that are actually changing the physical makeup of the bean. So we'll typically push the temperature up and it'll go into first crack, and you'll actually hear popping noises almost like popcorn. But here we just dump the beans. So once we dump the beans, like I said, it'll rise in temperature all the way till we get to first crack. And then there's actually kind of a waiting period and then second crack. Typically we'll stop the beans before they get into second crack. But that's a lot of what you're measuring on the roast profile is, when did we get the first crack and can we extend it once we get the first crack, and what does that do to the sugars in the bean and the complexity and what it actually tastes like.
As the beans roast, they begin to change from green to yellow. The smell transforms from grassy to something that resembles cereal. And about 10 minutes in, the beans reach first crack. A few minutes later, the beans are emptied into a big bowl with rotating arms.
Okay, so you hear that other popping noise. We just brought it right to the beginning of second crack. The bean starts to get a little smoother. It starts to darken a little bit, but you can bring it right up to second crack, which is also called full city. And that's, yeah, this is where we like to take this bean as far as the roast level goes. So this will just spin, and it's what it's doing right now is it's drawing air over, if there's a perforated screen underneath this, and these arms are spinning, and basically it's drawing the room temperature, or the room air, across it and cooling it. We want to cool this bean. We want to cool the bean as quickly as we can, and the quicker you cool the bean, the more acidity that you keep in the bean. If it takes longer to cool, generally it winds up not being quite as acidic, or so we've heard from some of our research.
And that's the basics of roasting coffee. Craft and Mason currently roasts three different blends: a decaf from Colombia, a coffee from La Concordia Farm in El Salvador, and a coffee from Sumatra called Bodhi Batak. As for their next steps, Eric says they're easing their way into this venture.
We're really just approaching this, honestly, kind of slow. We're taking our time. We want to build a brand. We're really focused on really online retail sales. And we're also focused on the wholesale market. We really would like to get more involved with some of the cool restaurants that are happening in the Lansing area. We're really focusing on the wholesale market and just online sales. And we're just taking it slow. We want to build our brand slowly. And eventually we would in the future, I think, we would like to have a shop probably or something along those lines if it makes sense, if it works. If not, we're happy with this too, you know.
I think that a lot of people are intimidated by coffee in some ways, by the sheer amount of choices, by, you know, the different types of beans you can get. How are you trying to make your coffee approachable for everyone?
Well, I think one thing we always focus on is coffee is such a great product that you can enjoy with the community around you. We hope that it encourages conversation. We hope that, you know, we're super geeked out about coffee and we focus on the tiny details. But we hope, even if that's not you and you just want a cup of coffee, that that it's something that you can sit down at a table with your friends and enjoy. And then that brings people together. I think, you know, with a lot of specialty food, sometimes people feel like they're not invited to the party.
Mm-hmm.
And we hope that with our product, that's not the case, that it actually builds community in the city, that people have fun with it. You can geek out as much as you want, or if you just want a simple cup, then that's fine too.
We've also made it a point to try to educate people, really. I mean, even in a lot of shops that are kind of opening up around here, I think sometimes there's this disconnect between people who really desire to know more about, you know, third wave coffee or this specialty coffee movement, but there's not a ton of education with it. So interviews like this really just help people, I think, get a better understanding of what specialty coffee is. It doesn't have to be, you know, crazy. People can get, like Jer said, as geeky as they want about it. But we also want to educate people and just let them know. Just like when we first started, we didn't know. We researched it because we're fanatics about it. But we want to just let the common, you know, person that's drinking coffee know what specialty coffee is.
Eric Kraft and Jeremy Mason together form Kraft and Mason Coffee. Thank you guys both so much for your time today.
You're welcome, absolutely.
Thank you so much.
WKAR. Current State's book reviewer, Scott Southard, chose the latest novel by English-born Scottish writer Morag Joss for his latest offering. Joss's book is called Our Picnics in the Sun.
We live in a loud world. Our movies are loud, our TV shows are loud, and the commercials are even louder. And sadly now, even our books are loud, filled with as many explosions and gunshots as any blockbuster film could ever hope to have. So, in a bombastic world like ours, how does a quiet book like Our Picnics in the Sun by Morag Joss find publication? Our Picnics in the Sun doesn't star spies or vampires or wizards. There aren't even any traditional villains as far as the eye can see. No, this novel stars an old married couple dealing with the difficulty of just living. Their names are even common. Howard and Deborah live in a small farmhouse and bed and breakfast on the moors of England, a land rich in fog and sorrow. They moved there many years ago, seeking a hippie-like natural lifestyle that was just not really feasible for them. This book captured me right from the very first paragraph. Whenever a book arrives for review, I always like to scan the first few sentences, just to get a small taste of what I'll be getting into once I'm ready to start reading. Usually I can return to whatever I'm reading after that, but not with this book. No, not here. This book gripped me from the very first paragraph, and I read the first 11 pages standing in the middle of my kitchen. I'm not sure I even took a breath. Howard, while doing his yoga, experiences a stroke, and we follow him as he fights to try and work out what is happening and then has to decide whether he is going to fight to move to find help or give in. It's disturbing, powerful, and the prose through this moment is spectacular and tragically beautiful. These first few pages alone make it worthy, in my opinion, for a purchase. Luckily, the rest of the book is just as well written. The book follows the couple after this life-changing stroke, with Deborah absorbing the time-consuming tasks of running their farmhouse and bed and breakfast, as well as now taking care of her invalid husband. She never gets a break. It is a lonely existence, and you see her world falling down around her. There is no possibility of change or happiness for someone like Deborah, especially after their son Adam decides once again not to visit them. Then, one day, a strange man in his 20s arrives named Theo. It is with Theo's introduction that the book's tone seems to take on an eerie air. There is something not right here, and you wish there was someone, anyone, that could step in before these characters continue down this path. One of the things I loved about this book is that it's obvious that Moraig Joss has a great love of literature, for you see the past's influence on this contemporary work. A favorite example is the romanticism of the environment around this little farmhouse, since it says more than the characters ever do about foreboding doom and endings. Yes, this book shares the same attributes that you would find haunting the worlds of the Brontes or the landscapes of Hardy. This novel also embraces what makes reading such a unique storytelling medium, for with Joss's skillful writing, we can get into the heads of each of the characters. No, the world doesn't lie in jeopardy like in other books, and by all accounts, the sun will rise the next day no matter what happens to Howard, Deborah, Adam, and Theo in these pages. Yet, Our Picnics in the Sun is unlike any other book you'll probably pick up this year, and its power lies in the written word. So waiting for the TV or film adaptation won't give you the same experience, not even close. See, there is beauty and importance in even the quietest of stories. For Current State, this is Scott Southard.
Scott's the author of two novels, A Jane Austen Daydream and Maximilian Stanforth and the Case of the Dangerous Dare. His writing on a variety of topics can also be found online at sdsouthard.com. His blog is called The Musings and Artful Blunders of Scott D. Southard. That's our show for today. Coming up tomorrow on Current State, we take a look at Governor Snyder's State of the State Address and State Senator Gretchen Whitmer and WKAR-TV's Tim Skubick join me to assess the governor's speech. Also, hip-hop and science may seem drastically different, but a new program is proving that together they can have a powerful impact. Learn more about educator Christopher Emden's project, Science Genius Battles. That and more, Friday on Current State. The executive producer of Current State is Peter Worf. Joel Lindstroth's our producer. Thanks also to Kevin Lavery, Melissa Benmark, Emmanuel Berry, and Scott Pohl, Aaron Young for engineering, and Hannah Michael John for production assistance. Thanks for joining us on Current State on WKAR.